Surface of Stonemouth, the town run by rival criminal families. A harmless game of pool can turn vicious without warning. David Tennant reads part four of Ian Banks's new novel.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel?
Regal Tables, Stonemouth's premier snooker and American pool venue for over 30 years, occupies an old cinema on the High Street. BB and I are just starting our second game when I see a group of four guys come in and look towards us. Two are big, heavy-set guys. One is kind of normal and the other one's wee and nervy-looking. They take the table next to ours. The first time it's my turn to play at the same time as the wee guy on the other table, we both want to use the aisle between the tables at once. I stand and wait for him to finish, but he's shaking his head and keeps standing up and looking like he's about to take his shot but then changing his mind. After about 5 minutes of this shite, I sigh and pull my phone out to check the time. He swaggers towards me, wee eyes screwed up.
"You taking the piss?"
"Look," I tell him, "we're just here like yourselves to have a quiet game of pool."
"No, you're not. No, you're not. You're just here to try and take the piss at me."
"No wanting any trouble," BB says in a sort of muted rumble.
"Oh, don't be daft," I begin,
and instantly know this is a serious mistake.
"You calling me daft, Jab?"
"He called you daft, D-cup,"
one of his big mates says. D-cup? Perhaps it was T-cup. But Teacup would be a shit street name. It was definitely D-cup. BB's useless. I haven't even been near a fight in 10 years, and the staff here would appear to be pals of D-cup and his chums. "Look, I talked with Don Murston just yet."
"I don't care who you talk to."
"This isn't supposed to happen," I want to wail. "Mr. M said it was okay for me to be here." Then there's a hint of movement in the darkness to one side of me.
"Problem here, ladies?"
The flicker of movement resolves into Powell Imrie, appearing as though out of a trapdoor. D-cup registers who it is.
"Aye, Mr. Imrie, this shitbag has been a shitbag, that's what the problem is."
There's the briefest pause here before Powell looks at me and smiles.
"Hello again, Stuart. You all right?"
"I'm fine."
"D-cup, isn't it?"
he says. "Can I show you a wee trick, D-cup?"
"Eh? What?"
Powell moves a few millimetres closer to D-cup, towering over him.
"Put your hand down on the table."
"Oh, shit, Powell, Mr. Imrie, please."
"Just put your hand down.
On the table. Flat." He takes the wee guy's right wrist and places his hand flat on the base for him.
"Fingers together."
When D-cup's hand is flat on the table, Powell hooks his left leg behind D-cup's knees without touching him, then pushes him quickly on the chest with his free hand. D-cup yelps and starts backwards, falling over as he encounters the leg Powell has curled behind him. The whole hand on the table thing was just distraction.
"Good trick, eh?"
Powell says, to nobody in particular. Then he comes up to me and puts an arm round my shoulder.
"Hired the car for a week, that right?"
"Uh-huh."
"If you did need to go earlier, though, you could, eh?"
"Earlier?
Monday evening. Or afternoon, see?"
"Why would that be, Powell?"
"Well, you know, the boys."
"The boys? You mean Murdo, Fraser, Norrie?"
"Bit headstrong. Can be. That's all."
Then, with a final tap-tap on the elbow and a glance and a nod at everybody else round our two tables, he's off.
Everything turned around. Checking up, saw you wanna do. If I could, maybe I'd give you my world.
The Deep Blue 4 is a mega trawler, and the crews are Mike Makovitz's main supply of muscle. Things are running a little late, so Mike phoned me to say come to the docks rather than the house. Partly, though, I think he still feels the need to impress people with the sheer scale of the new boat. Mike shakes my hand and I try not to wince. "Good to see you, Mike." He bustles me away down the various ladders and steps to the quayside and his Bentley. 10 minutes later, we're at the Makovitz house, a Scots baronial stone pile at the far end of Marine Terrace. We're barely sitting when his phone goes, and then he's frowning and saying,
"What do they want? Aye, hold the fortress, but out there."
I hear the front door close. I stand, looking out at the haze over the sea for a while, going back over the near rumble at Regal Tables. Not good. Too close a thing. "Stuart, oh my God, is that you?" It's Mike's daughter, Angelica, in a long pink toweling robe. "It is you. Hey, how are you, stranger?" Angelica comes running up and pretty much throws herself at me, the robe flying open as she tears across the parquet and revealing a tiny pink bikini and lots of tanned skin. I sit back on the window ledge, arms folded. "How are you, Jill?"
"Oh, I'm fine. You seen herself yet?"
Ellie,
no, not so far. Don't know if I will. She really messes people up, that girl."
I look at her for a moment or two. "Yeah, whereas you and I..." But the only things I can think to say are hurtful and sort of pointlessly petty. I've learned, belatedly, not to say stuff like that just because I feel I need to say something, anything. She lunges forward, stands, gathers her robe about her.
"I better get dressed." She hurries to the door, then turns. "Sorry, how rude. Can I get you anything?"
"No thanks, I'm fine." She nods slowly.
"Yes, and no," she says. Then she's gone.
Mike comes back. We chat. All is well. Business is good. Things are calm. He's sorry my stay in Stonemouth can't be longer, but, well, that's just the way things are. The front door has only just closed, and I'm halfway up the garden path heading back to the street when I hear the door open again. It's Angelica, dressed now, in tight jeans and a scoop-neck tee.
"Here," she says, thrusting a container into my hands. "Mum baked this morning."
"Thanks."
"Welcome."
Then she turns and goes. I open one end of the container and stick my nose in, smelling flour both baked and not, and a faint hint of strawberries. A scent that always takes me back to the Ancrum family's estate and a succession of summer days, half my life ago. Malcolm Henry, wee Malky, was just one of those kids. He came from one of those families you needed a diagram and some drafting skills to describe properly. There was a husband, wee Malky's dad, but he was in Peterhead Prison, where he'd been since shortly after wee Malky was born. The only way to get wee Malky really upset was to diss his dad. Callum Murston once asked him if his mum had moved to Stonemouth to be handy for Peterhead in the prison, and wee Malky just went berserk. He flew at Callum like something out of a catapult and had to be prized off him. Callum was left bruised and with a badly bitten ear. He clearly wasn't happy about getting attacked like that, and a couple of playtimes later, wee Malky got marched round the back of the bike sheds and given a good kicking by Callum and his older brother Murdo. The Ancrams had children within our age range. We were all about 13 or 14 at the time. Hugo Ancram was a lanky boy with fair hair, blue eyes, fine features, and an English accent. That was how to wind Hugo up. Accuse him of being English because he talked the way upper-class Scots who've been to private schools tend to.
"Go on, Hugh, call us Oikes!"
Hugo had been given a lot of paintball gear for his birthday that year. A dozen guns, sets of body armour and face masks and so on.
"Now look," he said one day. "My brother's supposed to be tagging along today. If anybody's got a problem with that, well, tough."
"Whatever, Hugh," Ferg said, shrugging.
"No probs,"
Josh McAvett agreed.
"Aye,"
Callum Murston said. Hugo looked relieved.
"Good.
Now, boys, this is George," his mother told us, leading him by the hand.
Hugo's brother was nearly 20, but his mental age was stuck at 5.
"I hope you'll take good care of him and play nicely. Do you promise?"
We all agreed that we did.
"Don't you worry, missus,"
wee Malky said.
"You can depend on us, ma'am," Ferg told her.
The sun was still high over the hills as the afternoon started to draw to a close and we set up for the last game of the day. A complicated arrangement of scoring across the various skirmishes and the different team combinations had resulted in wee Malky coming out last, so he had to be the prey. Basically, he got a 2-minute start and then we all chased him. If he lasted for half an hour or got back to his bike without getting splattered again, he'd won. George's deep voice rumbled into action.
"May I have a gun too this time, please?"
He was the least paint-spattered of us, though even he'd taken a couple of stray hits, partly due to his sheer size, you had to suspect. "Now, George," Hugo told him. Callum lost wee Malky and blundered off into a bog, getting very annoyed. Most of the rest of us set off up the same path, while Hugo and George and Felpie took the most direct route back to the house. This party of three was halfway back when they heard a lot of shouting uphill and assumed that wee Malky had been spotted. Hugo left George in Felpie's charge and climbed a handy tree to take a look. When he got back down, George had gone.
"You were supposed to look after him," Hugo roared at Felpie. "Aye so, I told him not to go. What else could I do, man? He's a monster."
"There he is," Josh yelled.
Josh had spotted wee Malky running along the top of the dam wall, sprinting like a hare for the far side where the overflow was. Down at the bottom of the grassy slope, stepping down the half metre into the concrete channel and then wading upstream to the foot of the overflow slope was George, holding, in both hands, a sword almost as big as he was.
"Where'd that come from?"
Felpie breathed beside me. My throat didn't seem to be working properly.
"House,"
I managed to say, gulping, remembering the circles and fans of weapons arrayed across its walls. Nobody followed Hugo down the grassy dam. I suppose that sword, suddenly so adult compared to our play guns, had sent a chill through all of us. Everything felt very still, as though the air had coagulated around us. While we were all watching this, Callum raised his gun and fired, hitting wee Malky in the head with a yellow squirt of paint. Wee Malky yelped and fell, splashing into the water on the overflow side, one arm reaching out to try to grasp the round stones at the summit, but failing. He started sliding down the slipway, arms flailing as he tried to stop or slow himself.
"It's over," Callum roared down at George. "Put the blade down!"
Wee Malky sounded hoarse with fear as he raced down towards the slipway foot. George stood there, the sword raised above his head.
"George!"
Hugo screamed. Callum screamed too and started firing at George. Wee Malky sort of draped round a stone pillar, a step away from George, who turned and brought the sword down from high above his head, whacking into Wee Malky's body, making it jerk. George paused, straightened, raised the sword high again. We never saw George again. He went back into a secure unit and stayed there until he died a couple of years back. People blamed Callum partly, though he always swore he had been trying to think ahead and had shot wee Malky purely so that George would accept that the game was over and put down the sword. Only Ferg and I really blamed Felpie. He works for Mike McAvitt now. We all got counselling. I hate to think how bad my nightmares might have stayed without it. I spent the evening with my parents. They wanted to congratulate me properly for joining the partnership. Mum drove us out to the Turry Inn, near roadside of Durrans on the Lonestone Road. Fine meal, fine wine. Quietly pissed, but feeling like a child again, I watched through the side window of the Audi as a waning moon like a paring from God's big toenail flickered between the black trunks of sentry trees, ridging lines of distant hills.
Stonemouth was read by David Tennant. It was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4.